This is Public Radio's Best. I'm Matt Laubach. On today's show, former Governor Barbara Roberts speaks on her new book, Up the Capitol Steps, A Woman's March to the Governorship. She tells us her story of her rise to power, beginning as a school board member to Secretary of State to Oregon's first woman governor. She spoke at an event sponsored by the University of Oregon Wayne Morris Center for Law and Politics in October. The director, Margaret Halleck, introduces the speaker.
When introducing an accomplished person, one usually talks about the positions that he or she has held and their accomplishments. But in the case of Barbara Roberts, you have to understand the person to truly grasp her career and her accomplishments. Yes, she's held a lot of positions. She was on a school board, a community college board, a state legislator where she was majority leader, secretary of state, governor, and university professor. That's quite a list. But it is her compassion, her courage, her energy, her grit that, in my view, really set her apart from others who have a similar resume. Barbara Roberts entered politics as many women do enter politics, and that was trying to fix problems in systems that are designed purportedly to assist people but don't quite get there. In her case, she became an advocate for special needs children and was a lobbyist and campaigned hard for educational rights for all children, including her autistic son. And this was in the 1960s and the 1970s, before that was a big issue, and she was truly a pioneer. So she was a citizen lobbyist at the legislature first, and that launched her into a brilliant political career. Governor Roberts is the most compassionate and courageous politician I have ever met. She is always optimistic and sunny, but she knows and has known shattering grief and deep despair. In her memoir, which I commend to you, she movingly describes her divorce, the death of her father, the painful death of her husband, Senator Frank Roberts, 3 years into her term as governor, and the death of her sister. She has shared her lessons and thoughts about compassion and grief. In 2002, she published a book called Death Without Denial, Grief Without Apology, A Guide for Facing Death and Loss. So this was her first book, and her memoirs, which she'll speak about today, is her second book. But she also let those experiences affect her in a very good way. So she never forgets what it's like to be in poverty, to have serious challenges, illnesses, and other misfortunes. She's famous for many causes, including human rights, human services, education, election reform, and streamlining government. But the thing that stands out to me always is how she governs. Like many women in high office, she leads from the middle. She's always building consensus, talking about collaboration, and listening, as well as the more traditional leadership stance of leading from the front. If you've never been around a governor's office, I commend that to you as well. A governor is a chief executive who is responsible for a staggering array of policies and programs. A short list would include transportation, education and training, human services, natural resources, environment, land use, and revenue. That's not the whole portfolio. So to be a governor is very, very difficult in the best of circumstances. But Governor Roberts did not have the best of circumstances. On the day she was elected, in November 1990, voters passed our infamous Measure 5, which is a property tax limitation measure, which has had a profound impact on the structure of state government and its revenue sources. And from the beginning, she faced a crisis with the spotted owl, which really turned upside down the main industry in Oregon at that time, the timber industry. And please allow me one personal note. I was able to take a leave from the University of Oregon to work with Governor Roberts on her conversation with Oregon. Right after Measure 5 passed, she initiated a very gutsy marathon of meetings all around the state and directly dealing with the public, as well as through public TV, which was a brand new concept in those days, this EdNet TV. It was an educational and a political experiment, and I was one of the U of O professors that served as a participant evaluator. Conversation with Oregon was really an amazing process, and it has been emulated by many other direct democracy experiences. Unfortunately, the legislature did not pass the tax recommendations that she put forward, and we're still stuck with our antiquated tax system, and I think every governor since then is, don't worry, it's a second-term issue. So I count myself very fortunate to work with this incredible bundle of energy that's known as Barbara Roberts. And with that, please welcome a remarkable politician and a heroine of mine, Governor Barbara Roberts.
Thank you, Margaret. When someone mentions that you have published an autobiography, there is a sense that this is all about ego. And there may certainly be a dose of reality in that reaction. However, for me, there was a much bigger motivator. My belief in the importance of capturing and preserving history. For in reality, it was my belief in the role that history plays that led to my decision to write my life story. I sometimes laughingly refer to myself as an historical artifact. After all, it's been over 20 years since I was inaugurated as Oregon's first woman governor. My portrait hangs in Oregon's capital. I have some things named after me. But when all is said and done, we seldom read the names on government buildings, and most people don't visit the state capitol to peruse the portraits of old governors. Yet I currently find myself immersed in a period of historical reflection. It started about 10 years ago when I was encouraged to donate my personal papers to the library at Portland State University. As I prepared my papers, I sorted through literally thousands of items, speeches and keepsakes and mementos and letters and photographs, and I divided them into labeled boxes. And I sorted and I sorted and I sorted. And I began to think of them as the boxes of my life. Family, school board, legislator, secretary of state, governor, higher ed faculty. And then finally, the assembled boxes, 47 large cardboard containers, went away. And I breathed a sigh of relief. My papers would be in good hands. My garage and attic were definitely not archival settings. Now what felt like years of clutter and collection had suddenly become a preserved piece of history. But it was also that year-long sorting project that, rather than freeing me, would envelop me deeply in the past for another 5 years. From sorter of the past, I would soon become writer and recorder of the past as I undertook writing my autobiography, a book that would include my 4 years as Oregon's governor. However, the historical trajectory that I did not yet understand was that my new book would be released just in time for the 2012 year-long celebration of Oregon's centennial of the passage of women's right to vote in our state. That's okay to feel. I could not have asked for a more exciting historical match. As Oregon focused all through last year on this centennial celebration, I had dozens of opportunities to be in museums and libraries, classrooms, and stages, me and my book. It was a year of fun and excitement, learning and sharing. Oregon's Century of Action, as it was called, became very personal as we read aloud from letters written by suffragists over 100 years ago. We examined photographs. We learned suffrage songs. We wore period clothing. We reenacted voting debates. This story became more than a brief paragraph or two in a history book. It literally came alive. First-hand accounts have an ability to not only record history, not only teach and educate, but to transport the reader back to another time, to another place, to another experience. History is not meant to sit on a shelf gathering dust. And it was with that understanding that 6 years ago I undertook the huge project that only a few elected women in our country have completed. In fact, at the time I began writing my autobiography, Governor Madeline Cunin of Vermont was the only female governor in our country to have put her life story on paper. Her book, Living a Political Life, was published in 1994. A decade later, no other woman governor had published her life story and shared what it was like to campaign for and then serve in her state's highest office. As one of America's first 10 women governors, I was becoming concerned that our place in history would essentially go unrecorded, told perhaps by others, but not by the women who politically pioneered those positions. Four of America's first 10 women governors elected in their own right are already deceased. This history is slipping through our fingers. It needs to be told. What takes a little girl from dolls and tea sets to the office of governor? I began to feel a need, an obligation to tell my story, to share a piece of the puzzle that helps complete the picture of America's early women governors. And so I began writing. My family, my childhood, my youth, my first marriage, the birth of my two sons. Month after month, I wrote, chapter after chapter. My memories became a manuscript. Now, I started with the idea that this book could be a cinch. After all, I was there for every day of my life. All I had to do was just put it on paper. Well, surprise. After more than 5 years of work and writing, I recognized that I had been traveling an emotional road, unpacking the boxes of my life. I had become part storyteller and part self-therapist. This project felt absolutely endless as the years passed, but the ever-increasing page count and the slowly added chapters gave me hope that a real book was in the making. And finally, we were in the editing stage, my absolutely least favorite part of this project. Lots of give and take was required, especially when my editor sliced paragraphs that contained my pearls of wisdom. Yet I had to decide when to let go and when to stand and fight for stories I believed were essential. At last, we were making the final decisions on the cover photo and the title page for my book, Up the Capitol Steps. So for the next little while, I would like to share with you several short readings that I hope will give you a feel for my story, for the personal and political journey from small-town girl to governor of Oregon. Now, I only have one request while I'm reading to you. Some of you may recall when you were younger that your parents read to you with only one purpose in mind, to get you to go to sleep. I would like to tell you that is not my purpose today. So if you can stay awake, I would appreciate that. I will start where the story should begin. I'm going to skip to chapter 2 and read a little bit from the chapter called Small Town Girl to give you a little sense of how I grew up. Few acts of chance have more influence on our lives than the family we are born into. I was one lucky little girl. I was born in Corvallis, Oregon. Never mind that. I know we're in Eugene. On the first day of winter, December 21st, 1936, and so that you don't have to calculate, I'm 76, I was born in a household filled with love and kindness and respect. My mother was a farmer's daughter from Montana. My father was a preacher's son from Oregon. They met in an Oregon logging camp where my dad, Bob Huey, worked in the mill, and my mother, Carmen Marie, cooked for the work crew. They married in 1935 and were married for 55 years until my father's death. Whatever there is about me that is solid came from that home and that upbringing. My father gave up lumber mill work at the end of the 1930s and became a skilled machinist. In 1940, our family of four moved to Los Angeles, California. Just before my fifth birthday, our world changed dramatically with the bombing of America's naval fleet at Pearl Harbor and the entry of the U.S. into World War II. Uncles and cousins went to war. My dad's plant was converted to wartime production. When World War II ended in 1945, my parents decided that Los Angeles might not be the best location to raise two little girls. They thought we'd be safer and more sheltered in some small Oregon town. They wanted my sister and me to experience a sense of community that comes from small-town living. So from the city of Los Angeles, burgeoning in post-war growth, we were suddenly living next to a small country highway with the Yamhill River running across our backyard, 4 miles from the closest small town, and attending a one-room school without indoor plumbing. I came from a huge Los Angeles school and almost literally stepped back into another century. Yet I've always been grateful for that experience. I learned to read and to study while other activities were happening all around me. And I learned how long I could hold my breath in an outhouse. When I was in the fifth grade, my family moved to Sheridan in Yamhill County. Sheridan was a fun, secure, safe, happy place to grow up, a little rural town of less than 2,000 people. In the summer, I picked strawberries and green beans to earn extra money for my school clothes. I would put the next fall's wardrobe on layaway at the local mercantile and then work like the dickens to pay off the items before the summer crop season ended. Yet, summer wasn't all work. My girlfriends and I owned bicycles, and several of us packed a lunch, tied a towel to the handlebars, and rode out to a swimming place in a wonderful, sparkling little country creek. On a hot day, that cooling stream was totally inviting. The added attractions, however, were the local farm boys who showed up after their chores were done to cool off in this very same swimming spot. These bike rides were always presented as biking and swimming excursions and an opportunity to earn our Girls Athletic Association letters. We would never have confessed that these bike rides also turned into a great opportunity to practice our flirting skills. The truth be known, I never learned to swim. However, one summer I did learn to kiss underwater. It all sounds idyllic, and in many ways it was. However, there was little encouragement for girls to step forward, to lead, to question in the 1950s. High school girls did not become student body presidents. We were the secretaries of student bodies all over America. And just try and imagine this today. I was a student body officer, class salutatorian, speech competition winner, cheerleader, editor of the school newspaper, all this and much more. And no one ever suggested that I think about college. It was the 1950s, and in small town, blue collar USA, most girls married, had children, and disappeared into the kitchens of America. And nobody blinked. Nobody questioned. Not even those bright, motivated, energetic young women, not even them. Today, more than 50 years after graduating from high school, I can pick up the phone and call all of my classmates. It's not about cheerleading or being governor. It's about our shared experience as small-town kids in the 1950s. We still dance the same way. we remember the lyrics to the same songs that accompanied our growing up years. We learned to dance and kiss and drive in the same town in the same years. We shared secrets and we shared our lives. Who the hell cares about being a cheerleader 50 years ago? Not me. I care about knowing friends who knew me way back when. I care about our shared history. So there's the first little look at Barbara Roberts, who can kiss underwater. Now, let me find this next little piece for you. Margaret mentioned some of this, but I'd like to share it personally with you now. It's really skips a lot of years from being a kid to being an adult, and being an adult does not always mean that life gets easier. But the most frequently asked question I probably get is, how in the world did you ever get involved in politics? It's kind of like, what's a nice girl like you doing here? As the 1970s began, I was a mother of two sons, one autistic. My 16-year marriage was ending. My special needs son was no longer going to have an educational program. Challenges were piling up all around me. But little did I know that transition was coming. In the last months of 1970, and as they approached, our Park Rose Project parents had learned that the federal government was not going to renew the grant for our children's special education program. We all felt we couldn't simply take our children home with no hope of continuing their schooling. We needed help. We needed a champion to save our children's educational future. Our parents' group reached out to State Representative Frank Roberts, who lived in our school district. We told him about our children's crisis. We informed him of what we wanted. We were begging to change Oregon's educational laws to give our special needs children the educational rights that every child in Oregon enjoyed, except ours. Frank agreed to help us. He would have a legislative bill drafted and introduced and then assist us in getting the bill considered by the 1971 legislative session. We were all thrilled. Yet Frank was also clear we would need someone from our parents' group to present our story to the legislators throughout the next months. None of us had the slightest idea how to be a lobbyist in the state legislature. Frank offered to mentor whoever decided to take on the challenging new experience. I began to think that Frank's recommendation of one day a week in Salem was within the realm of possibility for me. I believe my boss at the construction company might consider giving me a day a week off work to lobby this important bill for my son. I spoke to several members of our parents' group, and they all thought it was a terrific choice to lobby for our kids. Me, not them, of course. My boss thought we could work around my new schedule for 5 or 6 months, and I began to get excited about the prospect of doing this job. It was all but decided by Thanksgiving. I was now passionate about becoming my son's legislative advocate. Mike's future was in my hands. I felt a new sense of hope for our children. Yet, as the new year began, I really recognized that I had a very big choice on my platter, to lobby or not to lobby. To cut my income from 5 days a week to 4 days a week, to go with my head or to go with my heart. Senate Bill 699 was ready. The question was I? My job was to stay emotionally and financially afloat. My boys needed my full-time attention. I didn't have the experience to be a lobbyist, and I certainly didn't have the money to buy as much as a cup of coffee for a state legislator. My state representative, Frank Roberts, said I didn't need to spend money to lobby the legislature. I just needed to tell them my compelling story about our children. I just needed to talk with all 90 members of the Oregon legislature in the next 6 months, working only one day per week in the state capitol. I just needed to meet with 3.75 legislators every Friday for 6 months. That and convince those 3.75 lawmakers that my son had the same right to a public education that every other child in Oregon enjoyed. What should I do? And then Frank showed me the legislative draft for our bill proposal. There it was in black and white. There in print was the future for our kids. And right at the top of the page were the words, introduced at the request of the Portland chapter of the National Society for Autistic Children. I could feel the tears coming. Our parent group had formed our own local chapter of the National Society for Autistic Children to advocate for our children. We had believed we could make a difference by organizing and stepping forward and speaking out. Our children needed a voice. Now I ask myself, how one collapsed marriage could be an excuse for giving up on our kids' educational future. I remembered the words from the song, The Impossible Dream, be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. I was hooked. I couldn't say no. I would wear my new label lobbyist with determination and pride. 2 weeks later, I marched up the long flight of steps in front of the Oregon Capitol building, prepared to change the world for the disabled children of my state. I was scared to death, almost flat broke, and didn't even know where to find the women's restroom. But before I finished, I would find that room and much more. 4 days a week, I worked my job as a bookkeeper and office manager at Lay's Construction. 1 day a week, I lobbied in Salem under the tutelage of Representative Frank Roberts. 7 days a week, I worked to stretch every household dollar as far and as thin as it would stretch. I tried to keep Mike and Mark feeling stable and supported with their father out of our home. In early April, Frank Roberts and I convinced the Senate Education Committee to hold a rare evening hearing. Parents, our special education teachers, grandparents, and my son Mike testified before the committee. Mike dramatically explained to the Senate committee members that for him, special education wasn't special at all. For him, it was all there was. I relentlessly pounded the marble halls of the Capitol for 6 months. My feet became swollen and sore. I tired of hearing myself make the same presentation, the same case to legislator after legislator. I explained to them the lifetime potential of children like my son would be lost forever. As parents, we all paid property taxes and income tax like other Oregon citizens. Our children, I insisted, deserved at least a chance for an education. After 6 months of very hard and dedicated work, on June 8th, Senate Bill 699 recorded 57 votes out of 60 in the Oregon House of Representatives. Two members were in the men's room. Governor McCall signed the bill on June 29th. Oregon now had the first law in the nation requiring special education for emotionally handicapped children. Imagine I had actually made history. It would be a full 4 years before the federal law, Public Law 94-142, would pass and give these educational rights to disabled children in all 50 states of our nation. My lobby assignment had been one of the most stimulating and productive experiences of my life. I discovered I loved the political arena and I could actually change people's lives positively in that setting. I wanted to continue to find a way to make that kind of a difference. Looking back, even now, I feel real pride in setting that leadership standard for kids with disabilities. I had changed their lives and in the process had changed my own. However, it would be quite some time before I would fathom the depth of that life change. So there's another piece of it. Now, this next piece I'm going to share with you is not one I usually read, but the one I usually read here, I just felt so uncomfortable about reading because both of these stories, the one I'm not reading and the one I am reading, took place during the campaign for governor. And since Dave Frohmeyer and I were running against each other, I wanted to be as nice as I could be today here at the university. So I didn't read the other one because I think it's a little harsh. And so I'm going to read you a nicer one. And but it's just a little short piece from the general election of 1990. This is post-primary election. Dave had beat several people in the primary. I had no opponent in the primary because nobody thought you could win the race against Dave. So I had a free primary. So this takes place right after the primary election by about 2 weeks. In July, Dave and I were invited to the Sun River Resort in Central Oregon for our first joint appearance. The invitation came from the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, a well-informed, influential statewide audience. This was not a debate format, but rather an opportunity to hear the opinions of both gubernatorial candidates on a number of issues of interest to Oregon citizens. Patricia, my campaign manager, accompanied me on the three-hour road trip, and we used the travel time to go over a variety of issues that might be asked by the newspaper publishers and editors at the conference. I was a little anxious about appearing on the podium with Dave for the first time. He was, after all, a skilled attorney general with extensive courtroom experience, plus a former Oxford debater. Although I had known Dave since he was a state legislator, I was unsure of what to expect from him in this new political relationship. Patricia assured me that I would do just fine. She pointed out that I knew Oregon issues inside out and had survived 16 general election debates in my 1984 race for Secretary of State. "You'll do great," she said. But just in case they ask one of those questions that causes you to say, "Oh, crap," under your breath, just go for it. The implication may have been, "What do you have to lose?" So we laughed and drove on down the road toward Bend, Sun River, a room full of publishers, and that one question that would set the tone for the rest of the campaign. The exchange between Dave and me was actually pretty tame. We took turns answering questions, and the audience soon recognized we had similar views on most Oregon matters. The moderator was about to wrap up the program and announced there was time for one more question. A hand shot up from the audience, and the moderator pointed at the person, and the question followed: "How are you going to vote on Measure 4? Measure 4 was an initiative petition ballot measure that would close Trojan Nuclear Power Plant until it met standards for earthquake safety, waste disposal, and safe storage. This was definitely an "oh, crap" question. I looked at Patricia, and she smiled and shrugged her shoulders and waited for what she knew would be my answer. I prefaced my response with a few short comments about my experience as the governor's representative on the Hanford Nuclear Waste Advisory. I spoke about the huge dangers we were facing at Hanford with leaking storage tanks and threats to the water table, and the fact that we were putting the entire Columbia River at risk with the nuclear waste being stored at the Hanford site. Then I said clearly, unless we can meet safety standards at Trojan, I intend to vote for Measure 4. The audience was shocked. The publishers and editors and reporters were all writing feverishly in their notebooks. They had not expected that direct answer. Dave followed up with a reasoned response about the need for Oregon's only commercial nuclear plant, which generated energy to create jobs, run factories, light homes, offices, and schools. He was clearly against Measure 4, he added. "I don't think the case has been made for a shutdown." After the Oregon newspaper publishers event ended, Frohmeyer and his campaign aides chortled over the major issue I had just handed them. During the time it took Patricia and me to drive back to Portland, two members of my campaign finance committee had resigned. We prepared a press release on the three-hour drive home, but it was likely a waste of energy and time. Before we could drive back across the Cascade Mountains, their story had hit every corner of Oregon radio and TV stations, Associated Press, and UPI. The general election campaign was only days old, yet that day, dozens and dozens of politically active and aware citizens and pundits wrote the race off. Over. Done. Finished, they said. I understood the moment the question was asked, and the instant I delivered my answer, this could well be a fatal political blow. The Sun River question had been phrased asking, what do you think about the issue? Or are there legitimate concerns about safety? Or how do you think Oregonians will vote on Measure 4? The result might have been much less shocking, but asking how I intended to vote left little room for nuance. I knew my answer, and I felt I had to be honest. Well, you know what I love? I love Oregonians. I love when they surprise you. I love when they reinforce my moments of personal courage. And they did exactly that on Monday after the Saturday Sun River event. A dozen new volunteers showed up at the campaign office. The next day, 20 more volunteers arrived, and the mail contained a small stack of envelopes with checks and thank you notes for the stand I had taken. For the next couple of weeks, support arrived in every day's mail delivery. We even received a few checks from citizens who disagreed with my position on Trojan, but respected my honesty and clarity. The campaign took on a new tone. Now folks are saying, you may not always agree with Barbara Roberts, but you sure as the dickens will know where she stands. What had for a short time felt like a political disaster had emerged as a campaign energizer bunny. We had lost two businessmen from our finance committee and gained a headquarters full of volunteers and dozens of envelopes containing checks from $10 to $500. And the press and media coverage were worth its weight in gold. It was certainly way too early to count me out. I was a contender. I'm going to skip a couple of things I might have done here for you, but I've got a favorite chapter in the book, and I get to read my favorite chapter. It's a chapter that is unique in the fact that we can't find anybody else who's held major public office who has ever written with any more than a sentence or two on this subject. Now, that sounds pretty hard to do, right? Well, this is the chapter about the state police who did security for me while I was governor. Now, I could go back and rename the chapter considering what's happened in America in the last year or two. I probably would rename the chapter, but it's too late. It's already here and it's printed and it says Good Guys with Guns. But that's the name of the chapter, so we're going to just live with that. So I hope. Many governors who have constant security protection find it stifling and intrusive. I made up my mind that I would avoid this frustration. I would do my job, and they would do theirs. I would never think of them as in my way. For me, that turned out to be a wise decision. I was rewarded with mutual respect, friendship, enlightening war stories, and hundreds of hours of great conversation as we drove throughout the state. Very soon, I felt privileged to have their protection and their friendship. However, quite realistically, with only one woman in my protection unit, most times I was completely protected by only male officers. For years, I had been active in women's rights work, so my officers sat through events for the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, the League of Women Voters, and Planned Parenthood. Often they were the only men in the room. It was a little difficult to blend in. I also had years of involvement in the disability community and would sometimes be recognized in public by someone from that community. The first few times an excited disabled citizen came running toward me, arms flailing, voice shrieking, their awkward gait making them appear out of control, my officers were immediately on guard. But as time passed, my security crew grew accustomed to my diverse assortment of fans. One of my other long-term areas of political and civil rights work was focused in the gay community. I attended dinners and made speeches and received awards from that committee throughout my term as governor. And where I went, my security detail went. The best story to come out of this experience took place during the 1992 Democratic National Committee in New York City. I had been asked to deliver a speech to the first ever official evening reception for all of the gay and lesbian delegates at the convention. I arrived with two of my officers and my friend Terry Bean, an alum of U of O, an Oregon and national gay leader. We were slowly working our way toward the stage in a shoulder-to-shoulder crowd. Officer Glenn Chastain was leading the way through the crowd with me following at his elbow. The next morning, when the Daily Convention newspaper was released, the front page story contained Officer Chastain's up-close photo under the headline, "Gay Delegates Meet." By the time we returned to Oregon, Glenn's photo and that headline were on every state police bulletin board in Oregon. But the photo I wished I had, however, would have brought real laughs from the bulletin boards across the state. The unrecorded incident took place between my November 1990 election and my swearing-in ceremony in January of 1991. I was Christmas shopping with my mother at a mall in Portland and was looking for a gift that was on my daughter-in-law's Christmas list. Mother and I ended up at Victoria's Secret store, accompanied by two of my male security officers. The two male officers were trying to look invisible as they moved along the walls of the lingerie store. Focused on shopping, I walked behind a rack of bathrobes, and since I am barely 5'3", I was suddenly out of view of my officers. When the officers could not make a visual, they became concerned. They had lost the new governor. They asked my mother where I was, and she looked around, equally unsure about where I disappeared. In the quiet but fast-paced confusion, Officer Greg Lockwood backed into a metal rack of bras, spilling them across the floor. Hearing the huge noise, I stepped out from the bathrobe rack to see what had happened. Spotting me and knowing I was safe, Officer Lockwood uprighted the rack and began retrieving a rainbow of bras off the floor. His bright red face fit in perfectly with the colorful bras. We never let Greg forget the day he lost the governor in Victoria's Secret. But for me, this state police story wouldn't be complete without sharing a final special memory about my security team and my husband, Senator Frank Roberts. After Frank's death and his cremation in October and November of 1993, I decided not to inter his ashes until his birthday on December 28th. Once that decision was made, I felt sad that Frank's beautiful urn and his ashes were stored in the dark mausoleum vault in Portland. I decided to bring Frank home for Thanksgiving and Christmas. My state police always waited outside while I did business at the mausoleum, and this day was no exception. As I walked out of the door of the funeral home, I was carrying Frank's urn, wrapped in a black velvet bag. The urn and ashes were quite heavy, and Officer Daryl Burning jumped forward to help. He gently took the urn from me, set it carefully in the back seat, reached up and grabbed the seatbelt, locked it securely, and then sweetly patted the urn and said, "There, Senator, everything looks comfortable. So much for tough guys with guns." But this final story represents a special place these officers had in my life for 4 years. They made a tough job easier. They made me feel safe in some very threatening situations. They felt like family. They had my back. Thank you.
Governor, first of all, thank you for your tremendous service to this state of Oregon and also to being a representative for women leaders. My question is, when you became governor and you were faced with having very limited resources and lots of demands on those resources, how did you handle the equivalent of the Portland Parents Autism Society or whatever it was come before you, and how did you handle that?
Well, there is no easy way to handle the kind of cuts in state government that we took when Measure 5 passed. Every year since then, in all of those 20 years, it has just gotten worse and worse. But initially, because I was so well known for my commitment to people with disabilities and low-income people and homeless people, all of these things that had meant so much to me in my life, suddenly, as we started cutting programs, those were part of the programs we cut. There was no other way to do it. And that was part of the reason when Margaret mentioned doing the conversation with Oregon, people thought they could pass Measure 5. And I would add this just because I think it's geographically important for Oregonians. When Measure 5 passed in Oregon in 1990, it failed in every county east of the Cascades. All of Eastern Oregon voted against it because they knew it would hurt their schools and their local government, and they cared about that. Mostly it passed in Multnomah and Washington and Clackamas County. So people thought they could do what they'd been told was going to happen, that they could cut their property taxes and their schools would be protected. It wasn't true. We kept saying every governor in the state told them it didn't work that way. But it was a lot easier to believe that you could cut your taxes and everything would be fine. It was not fine. It's never been fine since. And one of the things I tried to do was to meet with groups all the time while we were making these cuts to help them understand why it was happening and why I couldn't protect every program or hardly any program. And out of that came the conversation with Oregon, which was intended to help people understand how the budgeting worked, how taxes came in, how they went out, and how you as a citizen had some responsibility when measures came to the ballot, that you were not just standing out there getting to do what you wanted to do. You became a legislator when you voted on a ballot measure, and you better know what it was going to do. So we really tried hard to do education and reasonableness with the conversation with Oregon, and it was very effective as a tool. But once we got the new tax plan, the reform tax plan designed, it was supposed to go to the ballot, and we lost it in the legislature by 2 votes. And otherwise, it would have been at the ballot. Now, I can't tell you if Oregonians would have supported it. I have no idea. It had a small sales tax in it, and you know how Oregonians feel about that. I have an Oregon birth certificate, and it's got a stamp that says no sales tax on it. But but it did have a small, very protected sales tax in it. But I would have liked to have given Oregonians the opportunity to take a look at it and to decide that it might be a good change for Oregon. But that didn't happen. So we cut programs that impacted all kinds of people that I'd worked for 20 or 30 or 40 years on their issues. It was very painful, very painful.
Okay, so I've met you before.
I know.
We toured the Capitol because I'm a New Leadership Oregon alum. So the thing I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about was, when did you realize, oh my goodness, there aren't as many women as I would like to see in positions of power in office. And when did you decide that's something that's really important to me that I want to advocate for?
That's a good question. I think I became aware of it fairly early. When I was on the school board, when I was first elected to the school board, I was one woman, four men. My career always usually went like that, that there were a whole bunch of men and a few women. But where it really became evident was when I went to the legislature. And we actually had more women in the House the year I was a freshman in 1981. We actually had more women in the House than we'd ever had in history. But it was still 19 out of 60. That the only good thing about that was that we could stop a quorum. And we figured that out. That was very powerful. But but as time has gone on, and I've watched the U.S. Senate, I've watched the legislature. I mean, we're here in Oregon. We've never had a woman president of the state Senate, ever. We've never had a woman state treasurer. Until last year, we'd never had a woman attorney general. So we have a lot of places where women have not taken full leadership yet. But part of what makes that happen is numbers. Numbers and talent. Boy, do we have the talent. The new women who were elected to the legislature in the last 4 years are maybe the most exciting, intelligent, prepared women I've ever seen go to the legislature. And that includes my own service. But the problem is they're still, in numbers, a minority. We do have a woman Speaker of the House, and that's only the fourth time that's happened in state history. So that's when I started doing a lot of mentoring work with women like the New Leadership Oregon program and at Portland State University. And I have, every year since that program started, I have played tour guide at the state capitol for about 40 women from college campuses all over the state. And it's one of the great thrills of my life to be able to go into the capitol with all these young women who come from every educational institution in the state and be able to talk to them about the importance of making political judgments, political choices, and convincing them they should run. And I tell people sometimes politics is contagious, and I got the germ, and I pass it on wherever I get the chance. So I have really loved working with that group of women, and it has inspired me to see them starting to get elected to the legislature, and they are doing that right now. So that's great.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Well, maybe you're just beginning to answer the question that I had, but it seems to me that once you've done most of the work that you'll have to do with your book project, I have the question of where do you see yourself fitting in now? Because you have the institutional memory, you have the understanding of the issues, and folks like yourself are so, so important these days to help focus on the most important questions that we've maybe ever faced. So you don't look to going to an easy chair and sitting in front of television, I'm sure.
I'm not taking up knitting.
Right. I know it didn't work for me either. So can you share with us some thoughts you have about specific projects or ideas that you want to be working on?
Well, I'm still working on a number of things in my spare time, of which I have almost none. I'm leaving here to go to Southern Oregon, speaking at Umpqua Community College tomorrow, to college students in that community college campus about the importance of being politically involved. I'm speaking to a Democratic group at lunch down there tomorrow in Roseburg, and I move around all the time talking to people and answering questions and talking about issues. But I also have some issues that are particularly important to me. One of the issues I've been working on for many years now, since it was on the ballot in Oregon in the 1990s, is Oregon's Death with Dignity law. And though it's in place here and working here fairly and carefully and compassionately, across the country there are only three other states who have it in place. Montana, that passed it through its court system. Washington, who passed it at the ballot. And Oregon, of course, also passed at the ballot. And the first state in the union to pass death with dignity in a legislative body was this year in Vermont. I have testified in Hawaii, Vermont, Washington, Oregon, California, a couple of other states about this issue. It's just a particularly personally important issue to me. And so it's one I will continue to work on because I think it's one I can make a difference. I remain very actively involved in civil rights for the LGBT community. And this next year, I have full intention to be totally actively involved with the ballot measure to reverse gay marriage from no to yes in our state when that reaches the ballot next year. And I'm going to a very expensive building the 3rd of November where everybody who lives there is rich. I mean, really. And it is the most expensive tower down on the waterfront in Portland. And I'm going in there to talk about gay marriage. They invited me, you know, and I'm coming, and I'm going to tell them what I think. But it's not. Thank you. But one of the other things that really matters to me, I do a lot of mentoring with young women, but also with candidates who happen to be the other gender. And because I want to have smart people of either or any gender in our public offices. But I also spend quite a bit of time working with candidates who are ready to run for office, who are just starting to run for office, who are asking for my endorsement when they run for office. And I spend a lot of time evaluating where they are and where they stand so I know whether I can give them an endorsement. And I had a special person say to me today, my daughter and wife and I used to sit down to figure out how to vote on election day, and we had the voter's pamphlet and we had all this newspaper stuff, but when we couldn't decide, we see who you endorsed. And so that was really special. But I make endorsements in races and on ballot measures because if my voice matters anymore, I want it to be there. And I want Oregonians to know that I do not endorse things that I think are not good for Oregon. And so I will continue to be very vocal about my stands. And there are some other issues that I'm looking at but have not yet made a determination that I'm going to be involved in. I'm going to be involved in the Wayne Morse Project for next year to recognize the 50-year anniversary of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution and Wayne Morse's vote on that. So voter registration. We had what I thought was a tremendous piece of legislation in this last legislature. Kate Brown, our Secretary of State, introduced it. It got through the House, and it lost by one vote in the Senate. And it was, I thought, the most powerful voter registration law Oregon could have. And I hope she's going to reintroduce it again. If she did, you may find me back lobbying again, just like when I was that angry mother. Now I'm going to be that angry former Secretary of State. So thank you.
That was former Oregon Governor Barbara Roberts speaking on her new book, Up the Capitol Steps, A Woman's March to the Governorship. She spoke at an event sponsored by the University of Oregon Wayne Morris Center for Law and Politics. For more information about this and other events in their lecture series, visit their website at waynemorriscenter.uoregon.edu. I'm Matt Laubach, producer of today's program. Thank you for listening.